Here we are, part two of the lecture, lecture eight. So I'm just going to do a bit of reading now. I'm going to do some reading now to try and catch up with all of the digressions that we went through. We're looking at the unity of validity, and we're looking at all of the exhibiting of a simple objective perception in different sensory modalities and in different perspectives. The exhibitings of the shape and the colour of the object. And we'll get down to, in running their course, they form, this is somewhere, I don't seem to have a mouse here. In running their course, they form a synthesis of identification or unification. I think that's where we got to, this sense of that something is being synthesized. This happens not as a blending of externals. It's not as if you've got a lot of different images that you then stick together. But rather, each of the individual aspects that we see are bearers of sense. Each means something, and each, in a way, each aspect that you see of the thing points to the thing. It's not as if you have to wait until it's done. Until you've done your turn around the object, you suddenly say, "Oh, I'll just stick that all together, and there's the thing." As soon as you look at something, it's there, right? That's what he's trying to indicate here. So in each phase, it's not a blending of externals, rather as bearers of sense. In each phase, as meaning something, the perspectives combine in an advancing enrichment and development of meaning. I mean, isn't that lovely? That's a description of just an ordinary. You've just bumped into something, and you've not seen anything quite like it before. You might just be in a shop, you know, and there's a little ornament you might think about buying, or a cup. You know, you're thinking that you're in the charity shop. Maybe I'll buy this cup. There's something amazing going on as you turn it around, of all these bearers of sense of forming this enrichment of meaning of your experience of this cup. Cup again. Generally, it's a mug actually. Yes. Such that what no longer appears. Right, which is the side that's disappeared, is still valid as retained, and such that the prior meaning, which anticipates a continuous flow. Do you see that, in a way, what you anticipate about the hidden sides is a prior meaning? It comes from your prior experience, and yet what comes from the past is projected into the future of an anticipation, which anticipates a continuous flow. The expectation of what is to come is straightaway fulfilled and more closely determined. This is another, you know, amazing part of this structure of experience, is that, you see, when I turn that mug around, although it's got water in, I'm clever. I was about to pick it up and the water was going to go everywhere, but my anticipation's ahead of me. I really don't know what's on the back of that cup. Now, I'm not going to be surprised. Do you see, my anticipation is extraordinarily structured. I'm going to pick it up in a minute, so that you're not shocked, and find out what's on the other side. But do you see, my anticipation expects it to be curved, knows about the shape, doesn't know if that image is going to stop, or doesn't know what the colour's going to be. But I'm not going to be surprised. Ah, it says Lion King, Walt Disney. I had no idea. But if I'd have, I didn't pretend or expect exactly what would be on the back. So I'm not shocked. I've actually looked in order to enrich my, what is the word? It's not exactly my knowledge of the cup. I'm actually enriching the cup itself somehow by looking at it.
Well, individual cup or the idea of a cup?
No, that particular. That and now, if I pick it up and there's nothing on the back, then I'd be surprised. Do you see? It's already now joined into that I saw the cup in its entirety to begin with, but now I've picked it up and turned it around, that knowledge of the cup has been enriched, and now I already expect what I've just seen. Do you see how it all builds up in this dynamic way? And yet at the same time, I don't think there's a new cup there now that I know what's on the back of it. Do you see how it all... There's an extraordinary structure going on here, which it mirrors, and I'm fairly confident that neuroscience is going to confirm this. It's going to mirror how the brain does it. But we, again, I have to keep saying, that doesn't mean that the kind of objective brain-based understanding of experience is true. Because it doesn't see what consciousness is doing. It says, oh, you know, a neuroscientist over here will say, yeah, that's exactly what we expected, John. You know, the neuroscience tells us that. What's missing in that view is that something terribly simple. The firing of the neurons in the brain is not my seeing the Lion King written on that orange cup. You've got to hold these two things together. Because without the brain, I wouldn't see it. At least, that's what experience teaches us. But that doesn't mean that the brain, the neurons, are seeing anything. They're the means by which I can see. So that was comes under, is straight away fulfilled and more closely determined. This growing structure of the my perception of the cup. Do you see? I'm perceiving the same cup, and yet, in some strange way, it's being enriched. It's changing, and yet the cup's the same. So I've got a deep intention in my understanding of being that points to the cup being something that I'm getting to know that itself remains the same. Do you see there could be another dimension to our experience where as I go around the cup, I could experience it as if I am creating that. That the previously, before I picked the cup up, it was literally blank on the back. And there would be, we're going to get to this later in the lecture, there would be some, that could almost be a coherent view of things if it weren't for you, John. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That you see the other side of it, and I just need to ask you, and you'll tell me what's on it, and then I'll pick it up, and I'll see he was right. So it wasn't blank before I looked at it. Do you, I wonder if you see that that's a kind of a demonstration of how terribly significant it is that there are others here, that it totally changes the aspect of what the world means. Otherwise, I could simply go around literally thinking, yeah, there's no back to your head, not until I get around there. Then it'll be there, but at that point, the front of you, your whole face is gone. You know, that's how we actually experience the world, isn't it?
That's how flat earthers think.
Well, now what are we going to do with the flat earthers?
Push them over the edge of the world.
No, there's still some of them around.
And there's still them. Okay. Yes.
Yeah,
they say, apparently this is beautiful, there was a quote on the internet, and it says, there's flat earthers all around the globe.
Once, for instance, you see someone's face, and you go around the back, you don't then think that face doesn't exist, but are you saying that the face would be blank if there were no other perspectives taken into account?
If you took it that in effect that your consciousness brings reality into being, then you wouldn't be able to refute the idea that something disappears when you don't experience it.
Yeah.
You could say, yes, I can. I'm gonna put my hand on the back of my head. No, no. As soon as you put your hand on it, it appears, because it's a kind of there's a level where you could say all that really exists for me is what my consciousness is showing me now. And it's not showing me the back of anything. So the backs of things, that's not there right now. And in a way, you know, it's not.
But at the same time, there's a difference between us, our consciousness, and the animals, because like cats, they hide, they think if they hit it their head, no one can see them because they can't see anyone. But that doesn't work for us.
But not all animals think that.
No, I was talking about cats.
Cats think that, do they?
How
do you know the cats aren't just trying to fool you into a false theory of cat mind? Yes.
It was an experiment done by Leo.
Was it?
I read about it.
But I'm only surprised because, you know, animals that think that way are likely to get eaten, aren't they?
Emus.
Yeah. Now, the ostriches burying their heads in the sand. Yeah. But this is not a good survival technique, is it?
They're still not extinct. So maybe there's something.
Maybe it's a last resort. If running away doesn't work, you know, might as well stick my head in the sand. At least that way I don't see that I'm about to be eaten. I can understand that.
Children do that.
Children.
But how do you develop it?
But do they really think that there's no place in hell? They're just like the game.
What I was saying in a way is the way that you.
I guess I do. Yeah.
The way that it disintegrates.
I don't see it. Doesn't exist. I make it unreal.
The way it disintegrates is when you understand that another is a perceiver like you. It disappears through empathy. So you have to understand that another is conscious in the way that you are, and then suddenly the world becomes the same world for you as it is for me. That's when it becomes unified in a way. It's no longer brought into being by my being conscious of it. If it's brought into being by consciousness, then in some sense this consciousness must be universally coordinated. I mean, if you want a kind of a happy thought, I find this a happy thought sometimes. The fact that we perceive all, I'm talking about transcendental subjectivity, the fact that we all experience the world in ways that agree is a demonstration that our transcendental subjectivities are connected. Isn't it? Because if you're looking at it, what the transcendental subjectivities are all expressing, all totally unique for each one of us, and yet when it comes to perception, we all agree. Now that means that in the behind, if you like, in the place where transcendental subjectivity has its being, we're together. And the demonstration of our togetherness is, it's a marvellous demonstration of our togetherness. It goes like this. Would you take the pen? Would you? Oh, you won't take the pen. Oh, you won't take the pen. The demonstration still works. The refusal's made. You see the pen. Yes, you didn't see some other kind of object.
And I agree.
And you understand my language. You see where it's...
And I understood the intention.
Yeah, yeah. The best way to feel good about life is to recognise what it would be like if you were to go around to everyone like that and they just didn't see it. They didn't see you. They didn't even think you were conscious. You see, we've got an extraordinary connection. Even though we go, oh, you know, I'm so alone and I don't have any friends. Yeah, but you can still say, can I have a cup of tea, please? And another being says, go away.
Sometimes,
in a very, very posh club I used to work there, and they don't see it. People, business, and politicians.
Yeah, people are in the front, they don't look at this.
Yeah, they don't look at it as if you're not there.
Because you're not a threat to them.
Yes.
You're really the same.
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah.
You're invisible.
Yeah, no, you're a gorilla in the suit, exactly. But in fact, yes. But there are plenty of them. We don't bother to look at them anymore. You know, we've seen, we know where they live, somewhere outside.
Even when they walk past you, you feel like you're invisible.
Yes.
But if you cross their way,
oh, you wouldn't dare.
Yeah.
I feel like if someone is talking, so if you have a conversation. Sometimes I feel I was invisible, so I could just join the conversation without you realizing me that I'm there. But it never happens. You always acknowledge that I'm there. And I sometimes feel that it would be nicer if I'm invisible.
Yes.
But there's the madness called solipsism.
Yeah, solipsism is that idea that it's taking phenomenology to its extreme, which Husserl does. He says, if you're going to look at what am I absolutely certain of, I am only absolutely certain of what I'm experiencing this very moment. And that would lead you to thinking that the back of the head is not there and that no one else is conscious. But we don't do that, you see. Our projection of the meaning of the world includes the being of the others who are looking at me, the being of all of these mirrors. I mean, it's have I done the deer story? When we were in California, we used to have, we were in a cabin, and there were deer everywhere, quite tame, and you'd feed them apples. They loved apples, and it just dawned on me one day that the deer who's eating the apple doesn't see me like a human being does. I mean, and in the way that if I just took all my clothes off, you know, peed up the wall, you know, whatever, that I don't care. I don't care that the deer sees me, you know. As soon as it dawned on me suddenly what a difference it makes as soon as there's just one other there. My whole, at every level, my being responds. Even if I don't say anything, I know I'm being seen. And the being seen is almost visceral. Do you know and how much we depend on it?
And I guess that then explains also attachment theory, where, you know, the idea that if you're not seen as a child, you don't have a point of reference to who you are.
But that's a kind of a deeper not receiving a kind of loving attention, isn't it? Because we're all seen in that way, even if we're seen and in a dismissive way, like the gorilla suit. Do you know, I'm talking about being seen at this very basic level, where it's like the seeing of the cup. When we see another human being, we project our entire subjectivity across into that viewpoint, don't we? And that it transforms the world for us. I mean, if one thing to do is to watch that movie, All Is Lost, Robert Redford's Ordeal at Sea. Have you seen that? I feel like I'm just going to ruin it for you. Do you mind if I ruin it for you? So he just goes, he just wakes up one morning, he's around the world yachtsman, and he's collided with...
Crossing the Indian Ocean.
Yeah, he's in the Indian Ocean, and he's collided with a container that's just floating there. He's driven a hole in his yacht, and it's wrecked the battery and all his electronics. He's got loses radio contact, and the whole thing's just him, just Robert Redford, no dialogue. So he patches up the boat, but he's lost all his automatic, you know, steering. Everything's everything's buggered, but he manages to patch things up for a little while. Then there's a storm, and you know, yada yada yada, it capsizes, yada yada yada. He ends up in the life raft, yada yada, and he, you know, boats go by, and he's waving, he's firing flares. I mean, there's a great scene of this kind of skyscraper of a container ship that just kind of doesn't see him. And finally he's in his life raft, and there's somebody out there in a motorboat, and he's run out of flares, run out of everything, but he's got a little bit of fuel for his stove left, so he piles everything up in the life raft and sets fire to everything that he's got in the life raft so that they can see the fire. But of course it burns the life raft, and he just sinks. And this is, you know, it's been an hour and a half, and there's Robert Redford, you know, he's just starting to just go down in the water, and suddenly a hand appears. That's it. That's the whole point of the movie, is that you experience what it means when the hand, what it means to be utterly cut off from humanity, and how much you love humanity, really. You know, makes me teary to speak of it, you know, because we just don't appreciate it, because everyone annoys me, you know, more or less, to some degree or other. Not everyone, but, you know, I go, oh, no, not another human, you know. Oh, no, not Boris Johnson, you know. Oh, for, you know, let me, I you know, Nicolette and I, we say, is there another planet? You know, but it's not really at the bottom level. When it comes down to it, that hand says, all of civilization, Waitrose, you know, warmth, comfort, shelter, books, conversation, embrace, that you know, everything that we that if we're deprived of it, it's just, it's devastating. You know, and it's all, you know, the whole meaning of life, if you get down in these layers, it's terribly profound. Just what we have, you know, just what we have each moment. But it's the old predicting. I know that. I'm just interested in what I don't know. I don't recognise the form of our continuous taking for granted of what we have. So the movie now, I don't think it's going to work when that hand comes down. Because when you watch the movie, you think, oh, have I, you know, I've done all this just to watch him disappear, you know, and now we're going to go out of the movie, you know.
Well, you saved us an hour and a half at least.
Yes. I mean, it's quite tedious, but that's the point of the movie, that you've endured all that tedium, and you've basically got to the point, you really do think, oh, he's just going to drown. That's why it's called All Is Lost. And that the hand. Have I finished this slide?
No.
Oh no! So the systems of exhibiting of are related back to correlative multiplicities of kinesthetic processes, having the peculiar character of the I do, I move. So the ways in which anything might change for you is absolutely keyed in to the way that you move your body, including your eyes. And the ways that you move your body, there are all these capacities at your disposal that in a way unfold the world for you. And they're quite, compared to the world, they're actually quite limited. I mean, we can do a lot of very complex things with our bodies, but, you know, if you watch me the way I move my hands like that, you'll find, unless I go, you know, I get training, that there's not, I'm running almost like a little program about how I turn my arm and how I turn it that way. They're sufficiently simple that I know them very well. And because I know them very well, there's something about it. If I pick up the pen and twirl the pen, it'll change in ways that are very similar to picking up this, and if I twirl that. You know, the speed and the rate that I turn determines exactly what I expect to see. So all of my expectations of how things are going to appear in my perception are absolutely tied up with my capacity to manipulate them, to walk around them, to move my head. It's all, everything that I perceive is relative to my body. And I mentioned this in an earlier lecture as sensory motor contingencies. That what the, and we're back to the brain, what the brain learns isn't the, to start with, isn't the invariant form of the thing, it's the invariant form of the way that I interact with the thing. Once I've learnt that, then I can, it's only on that basis that I can, if you like, take my consciousness of my own action away and see the thing itself. But the
affordances,
we were talking about affordances, yes, that was it. So the kinestheses are different from the movements of the living body, which exhibit themselves merely as those of a physical body. Yet they are somehow one with them, belonging to one's own living body with its two-sided character. Internal, and you were talking about this, kinestheses. Do you see the will, what we call the will that controls the movements and the sensations that we have? In interoception, it's called as well. It's a kind of an inner sense, even if you're with your eyes shut, of the positioning of your limbs. It's quite a, you know, because we think there are five senses. No, there's the inner sense of the positioning of your, of where your, where the different parts of your body are. You can lose that if you go still, but as soon as you move, then pop. The positioning of your body is all there.
And what's the word for it when you say external?
Proprior perception.
Proprior perception. That's it. I was trying to remember that. Yeah.
Husserl, as far as I'm aware, was the first to really make this distinction between this external physical perception that we have of our body and our internal sense of our body, and how, again, you know, once again, it's like seeing the form of the book, even though it's not rectangular at all. If you, it's the similar thing with the body. We've got two utterly distinct viewpoints on it, and yet they're all unified. I mean, that's something else that another human being does that the deer didn't do. You suddenly see yourself from the outside when there's someone else there. You have the sense of being seen, which is the sense of that you're no longer. It's like the difference between this internal sense of your body and the external. Another being there, you become, you see what you are for me, I must be for you. You know that, but you don't think that. It's all implicitly in our understanding. Normally, in continuous perception, a thing is there for me in the straightforward ontic certainty of immediate presence, certainty of being, ontic. For only when, giving my kinestheses free play, I experience concurrent exhibitings as belonging to it, is the consciousness sustained of the one thing in actual presence. I only grant being of this book or this pen insofar as it behaves when I move it as I expect it to. And in effect, the way that it changes is the way that it demonstrates its being to me. And it has to demonstrate it in a very precisely defined and determined way in order for me to accept it as being real, being actual. But the fact that the thing exhibitings belong to the altering kinesthesis implies that a hidden intentional if-then relation is at work. The exhibitings must occur in a certain systematic order. They are indicated in advance with this in expectation, in the course of harmonious perception. Everything I'm doing, there's something checking it. I go like that, my finger doesn't go through my neck. Right? I did it unconsciously to start with, but if my finger went through my neck, I'd be horrified, wouldn't I? Or I might think I'm dreaming. But of course, fingers going through necks in dreams, that's okay. The actual kinestheses lie within the system of kinesthetic capacity. Do you know we were talking about horizons? It's like all of the capacity for me to move my body, which is my capacity to make the sensory world change, all lie in front of me, like doors that I can open. But my kinesthetic capacities are doors that I can open immediately and directly within the living body. You know this living body? It's not just the sensation. It's this extraordinary capacity that I have. Extraordinary potentiality. So this system of kinesthetic capacity, which is correlated with the system of possible following events. Yeah? My movements and the events, they're all keyed in together, harmoniously belonging to it. This is the intentional background of every straightforward ontic certainty of a presented thing. Thank you. Next slide. Horizon validities. Breaks in harmony can occur. We've looked at this before, so I'll just read this through and hopefully we'll all just say yes. Being is transformed into illusion or into being doubtful, being merely possible, being probable, etc. The illusion is undone through correction by changing the sense in which the thing had been perceived. This takes place through a change of the expectation horizon of the multiplicities anticipated as normal. So, I mean, my example isn't the mannequin. It's the, you know, because I lived in Australia all those years. It's the stick and the snake. Right, when I'm seeing the snake, I've got a whole set of expectations about the underside of it, all the parts I'm not seeing, and how it should move. Yes? And as long as I have that expectation horizon around what I'm seeing, it's a snake. It's like you were saying, I think, about feeling a pain. I am seeing a snake. I even see the scales. You know, but I walk a little closer and something's not right. What I expected isn't fulfilled. That's why I realise it's an illusion, because my expectations aren't fulfilled. Now, remembering the hierarchy, actually what will go up, it'll cascade up the hierarchy, and I'll try and make it into a snake. But somewhere up there, it becomes more probable that it's a stick. And suddenly, it's like that. It's a stick. And down the hierarchy, stick expectations emerge. What was happening there? I say, well, there was no snake there. There was a stick that looked like a snake. But do you see it when you were seeing the snake, you were seeing a snake. And I've caught this. You literally are. You're seeing detail that ain't there.
And me talking of snake makes me shiver.
Yeah, yeah.
If I tell you I'm going to read Heidegger, but I read a different book that's not written by Heidegger, and you read Heidegger a lot, and I start reading, and you go like, "Oh, well, this is not Heidegger." After a certain point, there comes a point when you go, "This is not Heidegger."
Yes.
Right.
Yes, but it's stronger with a snake, and or seeing a bird in a tree that's really a bit of bark. If you, especially when you're a phenomenologist, you're looking for stuff like this, and sometimes you can catch an illusion where you can flip it. You know, you can actually go back into, particularly with surfaces. Sometimes they're they're really concave and you're seeing them the other way around. You can flip them and you can catch the whole thing and say, yeah, yeah, I'm really seeing it like that. I'm really catching my projection. You know, what's coming through the senses, and you know, neuroscientists are well aware of this, there's not enough actual information hitting the retina to tell you one way or the other. And all the time we're filling in the detail.
Or that the story about a person who never seen a kangaroo in his life, so when he saw the kangaroo, they thought it's a god rat.
Yes. I mean, the thing is, we don't see this filling of detail. How could we possibly know it? The thing is, most of the time, it works. It's an amazing how much it works. But also, a lot of the time, we don't even really test it.
Yeah. And it gets reimbursed with all all data available to us nowadays with the internet. We just take so many things for granted.
Now you're in trouble. This is the only place. This is the only place really now where we can pretty much, we're okay with pens. You know, get outside the door. What colour's the toilet? What colour's the toilet seat? Black. I see it black. Do you know, I see it black. I don't know it's black. Is it black, John?
It's white in the latest
one. This is the terrible thing about human perception. You see, it fills in the detail, but when it's stuff around us like this, we quickly get corrected. But it fills in the detail of things that aren't present to us in such a way that we take our projections to be real, and we end up understanding the world that way. The understanding the world that way was okay, it worked when we were hunter-gatherers, but basically we're living in a society where everybody has a fantasy picture of the society in which we're living. Just a fantasy
picture.
But if you realize what a fantasy picture it was, you'd give no weight to it whatsoever. But everybody's fantasy picture of the society in which we're living in has got all its details filled in, and it reflects back actual being, even though it's based on this terribly scanty bits of evidence. You fit it all together and you think the world is this way.
Yeah.
You think London is like this. You think Brighton's like that.
Yeah.
You think your workplace is like that. You know, these are all, you know, no better than the dreams that we have at night in terms
of Turkish nationalism. In the beginning of 20th century, they came up with this idea of what is Turkey, and in the middle of 20th century they changed it, and after the 80s they completely changed it again. So you see the people's conception of what Turkey there in the whole state propaganda is like changed a lot. So which Turkey is it, according to the Turkish nationalist, ultra nationalist, which Turkey are you talking about? Turkey is the fantasy in the beginning of the 20th century, or the fantasy now?
And I mean, just making it even a bit more practical, there's the whole question of what you remember. Do you know, when you remember an event, you project absolute, you fill in the detail, right? But you don't know. You just don't know which bits of the detail and which bits are true. Generally, until you bump into someone else who was there, and they start telling you, sorry to bring this up, John, because it might be a bit disturbing. But you know, when you got in that fracas at the disco, I was talking to Clive about it, and he recounted how he saw that incident, and it was quite different. Do you know, you catch this, how one's view of the past, you don't think you've coloured it at all, because you just look in your memory and there it is.
Mm.
Do you know, and you we just go around with absolute kind of ontic certainty. That's what it's called.
It's also confused with your own feeling of that time.
Yes.
At that moment.
Yes.
How John felt at that moment, what he felt.
Yeah, oh yes.
So then that fills in a lot of stuff in the brain.
So that leads to something, isn't it? That outside of immediate experience, we can't be certain of anything.
Yeah, but we've got a certain handle on the past. Yes, it's not complete fiction, but there's a lot of fiction, and it grows more and more fictional the further away it gets. And we can, you know, historians are involved in that task of trying to piece together what really happened. It's like a horizon where what's immediately in front of us is in fairly good focus, and the further we get out of that, the blurrier and blurrier it gets. But we don't experience it that way. Wherever we look into the past, it seems in sharp focus. We look into Westminster and Parliament, and it all seems in sharp focus to us. Do you know the whole world that the media presents to us? We look into, you know, we think we know Iraq. You know, we think, what do we know of Iraq? I mean, unless somebody's actually been. It's a total fiction. You just need to have yourself presented on TV. You know, we were talking about being sannyasins. It was amazing how that was portrayed on the media. As soon as the media is a kind of an extraordinary promulgator of illusion. Because they study it. They study how to manipulate your perception. Dear, oh dear. All right. Got plenty of time. Plenty of time. Shh. We're going by that clock.
It's a short pause. I love you and leave you.
Listen to the recording.
I will.
Yes.
Yeah, it's just my son.
Yes, I do understand. So we've got our illusion, which is what you see. What Husserl recognises is something quite deep. That all that really happens is we alter our expectations, and that's all. It's as simple as that. The thing also has an external horizon, not just this. He means by that the expectation we have of how the thing is going to evolve itself is an internal horizon. The external horizon is a thing as a thing within a field of things, and this points finally to a whole world as perceptual world. The thing is one out of the total group of simultaneously actually perceived things. But this group is not for us the world. He's pointing down on something that it's like an analogy. When we see a thing, you just see it, the surface that it's showing you. Yes? But when we look out now, I see the world. But it's like everybody here in this room is the surface that the world is showing me. Do you see? And I behind the surface that the world is showing me, I also project the form of the entire world, just like I do the form of the book, which is do it at another level. Yes, we've got a whole world form stretching out that is again a bit like it's not explicit, but I've got all of these behaviours that can unfold different parts of the world. You know, and I've spoken about this before. You know, one of the great ones is to catch some kind of transport to Heathrow. I mean, Heathrow is just a... You know, that's like... you know that in Harry Potter, those portals, those kind of... A portal where you just kind of get sucked into the portal, you end up in some other place almost instantaneously. Well, do you see Heathrow is like that? It's not instantaneous, but compared to, say, how it would have been 2,000 years ago, Heathrow is a portal. I mean, Heidegger does a very good job of this when he describes the difference it makes to a landscape when you put a bridge over a river. You just think, oh, it's just a bridge, you know. But in fact, you put a bridge over a river, it utterly transforms the river and all of the dwellings on either side of the river and all of the paths of behaviour that people are going to take. It utterly restructures the world. A bridge. Just to see the difference between... That's a kind of a picture of the world. The real structure of the world is like that. It's like the bridge utterly changes the structure of that environment. Just like Heathrow is now in our modern world, that's like a magic portal. You know, you can end up anywhere on the whole planet, pretty much, just by entering that tube. You know, the little tube you go into to the boarding gate. It's I used to sit on planes and think about it that way. You know, that again, the same thing. I'm not moving. You know, I'm in a portal, just taking me to some other part of the world. So this group is not for us the world, rather the world exhibits itself in it. See, the world is exhibiting through this, in the entirety of this room that we're in now, and the window out onto the rest of Brighton. You know, that, do you see? There's just an aspect now. But the aspect, behind the aspect is Sussex. Behind that, there's the English Channel over there. I could see France from Deal. I know France is over there. Do you know that? And there's all of my experience of France. It's all laid out. Where am I? This thing is one out of the total group of simultaneously actually perceived things, but this group is not for us the world. Rather, the world is... Yeah. Such a group as the momentary field of perception has the character of sector of the world, like surface of the thing, of the universe of things for possible perceptions. Such is the present world. It exhibits itself through a nucleus of original presence and through its internal and external horizon validities. You know, I feel that I'm not going to finish the lecture. I feel that that's inevitable now. I've got halfway through it, but I feel like trying to slam my way through is not going to be, it's not going to be fun. You know, just kind of trying to, and the communalized world is a new section here. I see it's a kind of, there's a break here, so I think we'll see. I feel almost that I've got a spare lecture. You see. It's either going to be a and I'm using it up. So we'll draw the curtain here, and we'll carry on here next week. But I'm going to give you the entire rest of the reading for next week as well, so that basically I'll have another class ready. Basically, we'll have everything that we need to get through, and we'll see how we go.
So it's next Saturday. Is that the last session?
No, it's the penultimate.
Okay.
There's one more after that.
I won't be here.
You?
I'll be in London, yeah. I'll see my mom. Okay.
All right.
Skype.
You can Skype. if we had wireless.
You can tell your mom.
All right, ending now.